Well, good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And of course, as you know, we always welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about what's really going on in the world today. And of course, the World Affairs Brief is actually written by Derek's father, Joel Skousen, certainly a good friend, and who's traveling at the present time. So Derek is going to bring him up to date on his dad's views on what are the most important issues of the last week. Derek, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us what your take is on what's going on in the world today.
Well, there's a variety of things that have been going on this over the last week or two. Most of it, at least from our perception, has been happening in a variety of different countries all over the world. A lot of our news stories that we're highlighting this week, except for perhaps some of the latest things out of the Supreme Court, have been going on in Britain and in the Middle East and in Asia and just places everywhere else.
All right, fine. So let's get right down to them. Tell us what they are.
Well, one of the big things that we saw, even in here in our media, was the big concert called the Live Aid. And this was designed to be a political concert. It was a very big event as far as music media goes. And it was designed to have a lot of high ideals in mind and got a lot of media attention. But I think it's worth talking about what the realities are behind such an event like this, and all of the discussion and the hype and the intentions, whether good or bad or misguided, and how they might all come together, and how much does a rock concert like this really influence the world is kind of the question I'd like to bring up.
All right. Well, how does it?
Well, I think that people who follow the news on a regular basis and start to try and put together from all of that information that they would see on a regular basis would start to understand that that groups of people in the range of thousands and hundreds of thousands who are going to an event mostly for entertainment don't seem to quite have a very strong grip, I feel, on why countries are really poor, why people are poor, why money doesn't always flow the way they expect it to. And without understanding that why, in other words, without understanding the world of the current events and the manipulations and the agendas and the other areas of focus that are under the eye of the people who really run things in both Western and Eastern and first world countries and third world countries, all of these people are not really listening to rock stars necessarily. I'm afraid I'm going to have to say they are really listening to an agenda that has to do with growing the power of the organizations that they are in. And all of the good intentions are not addressing the power plays that are really going on. And without addressing those power plays more directly, I feel that it's just going to be plain entertainment.
Well, tell us a little bit about this. I mean, you have this big festival, but, you know, what does this fit into the whole thing? Was this supposed to be gaining points, support for the Bush administration, or what?
Yes, I should back up and give a little background about Live Aid. Live Aid was designed to be a concert by some of the largest with some of the largest rock stars that are currently out today. Everyone from Mona to Madonna and so on. It was organized by the former rock star Bob Geldof, and he worked hand in hand with British Prime Minister Tony Blair. And the point of this was to draw people's attention to the plight of African countries and to poverty throughout the world. It was designed to be a grassroots effort to bring people's attention to the things that aren't getting done. The fact that poverty isn't getting solved, even though, you know, they've been having these kinds of festivals and concerts since the 60s. All of those 60s ideals have not been reached, so to speak. And yet, the idea was to bring the people together in a big event and in a media event, people who could command the attention of youth all over the world and bring their eye to what the leaders are doing specifically at the Group of Eight summit. In other words, the concert was designed to coincide with the summit of the G8 countries.
And this was, of course, where they were going to decide that we were going to write off the debt, some $40 billion, that was owed to us by African countries, right?
Right. Well, we know that's already been moving forward at a straightforward pace. And so basically what we're doing is, what the purpose of the Live Aid was to kind of draw the youth's attention by bringing in the people that youth apparently like to follow, the major musicians and entertainment characters, and have them all get on stage in a highly publicized event and talk about the grassroots issues that they think are important in terms of changing the world.
Well, was this sort of a plea for a world government, or let's all get along together, or we're all our brother's keeper, or, you know, and how, I didn't even hear about this thing. Was this being publicized? Was it being shown throughout the world on television? How were they getting the publicity for it?
So, the publicity was was largest in England. In England, it was published for weeks and weeks on all of the major news channels, and I might have brought it up last week, but I didn't get around to it. It's shown up in a lot of the standard media.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. He's talking about this gigantic rock concert that they had that coincided with the meeting of the G8 nations, where they were going to, of course, write off the debt owed by the third world countries, about $40 billion, somewhere between $40 and $55 billion. The figure kept changing depending upon where you read about it. Apparently a lot of publicity in England. They were going to have the major rock stars there, and they were going to tell people how wonderful it was that we were going to write off all this money. Is that about correct? Would that be correct appraisal?
That's correct. And so they did have the big rock concert. They had thousands of people show up. Parts of it were given publicity on a variety of media sources, a lot of it oriented towards kind of the youth demographic, you know, the 18 to 30 crowd, and really, you know, a chance for everyone to come together and talk about the issues that were coming in front of the, well, basically the issues that they would like to see come up at the Group of Eight Summit.
All right.
Now, what's important to understand here, I feel, is the fact that there is this apparent disconnect between bringing people together to discuss issues in a relatively euphemistic way, talking in broad generalities that don't nail down a variety of specifics, and the ability to make things happen. And the reason why I bring it up is I want to contrast it with the kinds of activities that you're doing, Dr. Stan, and Radio Liberty, in terms of educating people in by way of specifics about how the world works, about how politicians think. And as you know, as I listen to your various radio shows, Dr. Stan, I gain a broad set of education, and through these specifics we start to see patterns in the way that governments grow and in the kinds of influences that really make a difference on these kinds of government officials meeting at the G8 summit. When you get, in contrast, a bunch of kids crowding in a giant field listening to their favorite rock stars, interspersed with speeches about saving the world from greenhouse gas and rescuing Africa from foreign debt and all of these kinds of things, it avoids an understanding of what's really going on. And this lack of understanding misses the mark completely, because it plays into the political doublespeak of politicians and world leaders as they are now, without addressing the underlying motivations.
Okay, fine. So basically, of course, then they have this gala, and of course, was anything accomplished at all?
No. Well, people had a lot of fun.
All right, fine. And of course, but they were basically using this as a propaganda outreach to get the youth of the world behind this effort, really, at globalization. Would that be a fair statement?
It would be a fair statement, but it would only be a fair statement from your perspective and from my perspective, because in actuality, I don't believe that people really believe in globalism, in this, that these kinds of youth who are oriented strongly by their public school education background, etc., oriented towards a more left and liberal ideology and understanding, really have the same perception of what globalization is than what you and I perceive globalization to be. And so this kind of propaganda is rather insidious in that it openly combats a certain form of globalization when they talk about the globalization of capitalist businesses, and when they talk about the globalization of trade practices, etc. And they tend to be against certain kinds of economic globalization policies, and ignore overall the political globalization trends, and then their efforts throughout the rest of the rhetoric has to do with bringing people together to solve these euphemistic general feel-good principles of changing the world. And it becomes a trap for the youth and for the next generations that are to come. And this trap is that if you want to change the world, you have to band together in a globalistic, monopolistic, political world where everyone gets behind the same organization to make good things happen.
And I'm sure that this is part of this whole dialectic process. In other words, they probably align the young people against the wicked capitalists without ever realizing that this whole thing is being pushed by the very wicked capitalists that they're all becoming aligned against. In other words, they create a controlled opposition, and it was my thought as I was reading what you'd written about this, how clever these people are on the other side. They create an opposition, and they control the opposition.
That's right. And they create it and they control it by leading it subtly down a different train of path and by influencing the culture as it grows over time and taking the time to let this grow in a feel-good manner that blocks their ability ultimately to think clearly and to think about the underlying motivations and the risks and the dangers of the globalist political agenda that is moving forward.
And of course we see that here in the United States where they control the leadership of both the Democrat and the Republican Party, and everybody thinks they're in opposition, and yet they're all moving in exactly the same direction. But the people in the Democrat Party think they're opposing the wicked Republicans, the Republicans think they're opposing the wicked Democrats, and they're all being manipulated. Would that be a fair statement?
That's right. They are being all manipulated Well, they're being manipulated, and through them, everyone else is being manipulated. And so it becomes a more difficult job for us, I guess, ultimately, when we see what we're battling up against. It's not just the egregious and difficult and obvious things to fight that we see in the war in Iraq, etc., but we see it infiltrating the media from both political spectrums, and from outside of politics, in the world of entertainment, we're seeing this movement towards a common line of thought and a common way of thinking that is in generalities, loses specifics, and leads one towards an aligned methodology and way of thinking that, you know, is incorrect and dangerous.
All right, fine. Well, it's the oldest trick in the world. You always control the opposition, and then there is no opposition. And
yeah.
So they're mobilizing the youth, the impressionable young people who really don't understand what it's all about, and getting them to think exactly the way they want to, thinking that they are now anti-establishment, they are the ones who are going to oppose these global corporations, etc., etc., and yet all the time, of course, they're being controlled by the very people they oppose, but that's the oldest game in the world.
And so one of the interesting things that we think about here occasionally at the World Affairs Brief has to do with how does one educate the variety of people from so many different backgrounds, even here in the United States, how the youth of today are gaining such a different background from the folks in the generations that preceded them, and how do we teach them as they're growing up in the world to see a broader spectrum of what's going on. For all of the discussion of the politically correct discussion in the media today about diversity, there does not seem to be the kind of diversity of ideas that leads to a real understanding of what might be going on in the world.
You're absolutely right. It takes the average college graduate about 20 years to grow up and mature and overcome all the ideas that have been programmed into his mind in our universities here, and I'm sure that's true throughout the rest of the world. Some of them never do grow up, never do understand what it's all about.
Yes, even more so. Even more so in some of the other countries in the world. They tend to have even stronger agendas than the U.S. schools, if you could believe that.
Okay, fine. Well, I think it's a very, very valid point. Okay, was there anything else you wanted to make a point of there?
Well, I guess the last point is the difficulty in teaching in a positive light, because one of the one of the best ways to get people, to get the youth to understand, or to get people to understand about what's really going on in the world, is to show them the details and the negatives and the problems that are going on, and the risks that are inherent. And you know, one thing that I don't like to do here at the World Affairs Brief, but I think we tend to do a little bit too often, is create an environment of fear about what's going on. And we do that because there's a lot to fear in the world and in the way the situation is going. But really, there are ways to teach in terms of the positive news that goes on, and finding the directions in which we can see the loopholes and the ways to grow and the ways to understand more and the ways to go forward. I think one of the most positive things for our work here, what you're doing, Dr. Stan, and what I'm doing, has to do with the growth of the internet in terms of news. Sure, there's a lot of bad stuff on the internet, but the good news is that through the internet we have access to more news than we ever had before, and have an ability to learn more and study more and understand more.
And of course, if you are out there in the listening audience and you don't go to World Affairs Brief every day as I do to get the latest news, you really should. That's worldaffairsbrief.com, and they have an analysis of what's going on, and there are probably 15 articles, 20 articles. You can pick the ones that are important to you, pull them down, read them, and study them, and save them. And the others, well, at least you have an idea what's happening. But you're not going to get the truth through the regular media. Here's a wonderful alternative. It's worldaffairsbrief.com. We'll be back here in just a moment, here at Radio Liberty. All right, Derek, why don't you go ahead?
All right. Well, let's move to perhaps some of the more bad news that's
out
there.
All right, fine.
There is quite a bit of it that has been rolling forward throughout the week. A lot of it has to do with the news that's going on in the other parts of the world, but how that news is being manipulated here in the United States. Specifically, we've been seeing a great deal over the past 10 or 15 days about the state of the war in Iraq from the U.S.'s perspective, and how the Bush administration seems to be really gearing up their campaign, even stronger than others, to reach the American people and try and overcome their suspicions about the direction that this war is going. You know, it's really interesting to think. You know, we've been talking about the war of Iraq for, well, longer than the war of Iraq's been around, but it takes a long time for the American public to really come around to the suspicions under the onslaught of the feel-good stories that come out from the administration and filtered press from the Defense Department, etc. And now we're seeing that the administration and the Defense Department is continually having to notch up their efforts to maintain a positive attitude about the war in Iraq, that we will win it, that we will win it soon, in the face of the dramatic evidence that has been flowing from that area of the world. So we have a couple of stories here in the World Affairs Brief this week, analyzing things like Rumsfeld's admission that there will be several more years in Iraq, the president's speech at Fort Bragg, where he was trying to, you know, pull things together and argue his case. More on Italy and its complaints about the CIA's snatch and grab operation over there, and the news coming out about you know, what happens to people who get snatched and grabbed, since it seems to be happening more and more all over the world.
Well, for our listeners out there, why don't you explain to them what really did happen there? Apparently, it was a gentleman who was living in Italy who was had been turned by our intelligence agencies and forced to become an informant. And then, of course, he was actually picked up. He was kidnapped out of Italy and sent off, I think, was it to Egypt to be tortured, or what was it, Syria?
It was Egypt.
He was sent off to Egypt to be tortured, and we had 15, maybe there was more, but at least 15 CIA agents have been indicted in Italy, and they're demanding that they be returned for kidnapping somebody who was either an Italian citizen or under their protection. And you can't go into a foreign country and kidnap people and send them off to other countries to be tortured. It just isn't done in a civilized world. And this had been one of their informants, an American informant working within the Islamic movement. So, I hope that people will understand the implications of this, because if we have a right to torture people that we think might be terrorists, what about torturing Americans that they think might be terrorists? But nobody ever seems to want to talk about that. We seem to make all sorts of excuses as long as our side does it, without a realization that many times they're very wicked people working within our side as well. Would that be a fair statement?
That's right. What's key to understand here is, like you said, it's the trend that's going on here, the operations, the processes, and the policies that are going into effect, that these kinds of operations indicate.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Derek Skousen has been talking about this episode over in Italy, where apparently it came out that several years ago there was a man who was working there for American intelligence, and he had actually been informing and gathering information, and for some reason or other, we sent CIA agents over there to kidnap him and send him off to Egypt to be tortured. Now, what the reason was, what the justification was, but you do not go into a foreign country and kidnap people and then send them to another country to be tortured, because, of course, we Americans wouldn't stoop to torture. We'll let the Egyptians torture them because they're far more fiendish than we are. And so, you know, apparently this has created quite a furor. The Italian government now has, indicted these 15 or however many Americans that were involved, and is demanding that they be sent back to Italy to stand trial for kidnapping somebody, apparently an Italian citizen or somebody under their jurisdiction, and sending them off to be tortured. And where is the outcry from the American people? I thought we were the good guys. We didn't torture people. Oh, we didn't torture them. It was those Egyptians that we sent him to. And what people must understand is that our intelligence agency works with all the other intelligence agencies, the Syrian intelligence agency. See, I thought maybe they were the enemy. And then, of course, the Egyptian intelligence agency. And we work with intelligence agencies all throughout the world who torture people. And we send people there to be tortured. How do you justify that if we're moral people?
That's right. It's not just a question of how do we justify it. I mean, we're listening to George Bush try and justify the Patriot Act over the last few months, and those justifications, well, they're only more disconcerting in the efforts that they're making to justify such a clearly obvious case that's against American principles, and yet. They're not even touching some of these more difficult issues, like the ability for the U.S. to go in and kidnap other foreign nationals and take them and interrogate them in a separate country. But the most difficult thing, and the for me to accept, and the thing that I think we must all be aware of, is that this is becoming a standard operation. This is becoming a process that will become more and more natural for governments to operate with. And so we may be having the U.S. working hand-in-hand with foreign intelligence agencies to kidnap American citizens. And although we don't have a lot of examples of that yet, they are starting to come out slowly.
Well, there was a gentleman named Padilla who was actually an American citizen. He was foreign extraction, but he was a legalized American citizen. And he, of course, had been involved with illicit activity before 9/11, before the terrorist attack here in America. He was arrested immediately upon returning to America after 9/11 and has been held without trial ever since then. In other words, we have the right of habeas corpus, and thus, of course, they want to suspend it. And after all, maybe he is a terrorist. I don't know if he is or not. But shouldn't he have a right to trial? He has no right to trial. And in this day and age, we don't know whether he's guilty, whether he's innocent. But if they can suspend it for one American citizen, how about other American citizens who perhaps were not foreign-born?
That's right. So first you have the U.S., who's the U.S. citizens who are, the U.S. intelligence services arresting foreign-born American citizens and accusing them of the vague and undefensible charges of terrorism. And then you have the U.S. intelligence services arresting, for example, we have the Canadian citizen who was traveling through the U.S. and on his stopover in New York was arrested and shipped off to Syria.
To be tortured.
To be tortured. That's right. We have the example of the U.S. arresting a foreign national in their country and shipping them off to another foreign country to be interrogated and tortured.
But of course, the thing is, where is the outcry from the Christian leadership of this country? And the Christian leaders of this country justify everything the Bush administration does because he's one of them, he's one of us, as they would be the commentary. And as long as it's done by a Christian, violation of all international laws and of human laws itself, and a basic of human compassion, why, it's all right as long as we do it. And I don't think God's going to look very kindly on that.
That's right.
Go ahead. We've got about 30 seconds.
And where is the outcry, not just from the Christian right, but from the media and from the left and from you know, nearly every American, I believe, is against this process of rendition, whether it's foreign or domestic, and are against the principle of having of international intelligence services arresting people in their country. It's only one step away from having the Mexican government coming up and arresting us, or having the Swedish government coming out and taking people and arresting them and shipping them to Bolivia.
We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Derek Skousen, and we're talking about the things that are going on and the fact that we seem to be turning our back on what's logical in the name of fighting terrorism. And yet, of course, what nobody wants to point out is that the major financier of terrorism is our good friends, the Saudis. And, of course, some of the funding for the terrorist movement is coming from Syria, but our intelligence agencies are working very closely with the Syrian intelligence agencies. Another major financier of international terrorism is Iran, but who was it who brought the Ayatollahs to power back in 1979? The United States government foreign policy toppled the Shah and helped the Ayatollah establish his government there. So things are never quite as they appear to be. So pick up the story there, Derek.
All right. There's actually a variety of stories that surround this aspect here. So we've been talking about the principle of rendition, and it's important to note that while the Bush administration is continually denying this passage of the Patriot Act, that it is denying that it's done harm to American civil rights, I mean it's really obvious that our government is acting almost in a rogue manner in its disregard, not only for our Constitution, but for the Constitution of others, of other countries around them.
And, of course, the Italian government is furious that they had kidnapped a man in Italy and sent him off to be tortured.
Well, that's actually an interesting case that we've been analyzing in this week's World Affairs Brief, is that you're absolutely right. The Italian government has been furious, and the European press has been justifiably furious. It's too bad that the American press won't get furious in the same way. One of the interesting things, though, that we've been uncovering about this particular story is that despite the denial by Berlusconi's government that they had anything to do with that particular arrest, in fact, it was done hand-in-hand with the Italian government, and Italy's intelligence services.
No, they may have a rogue intelligence agencies just like we have rogue intelligence agencies, but somebody's controlling them. You can't blame that on what has just sort of happened.
Exactly. So even though Berlusconi's government is denying that, is you know, acting all furious and affronted by this particular action, which they should be, all Italians should be affronted by this action, the Italian government is behind the back of the Italian people, betraying them on this particular story. The CIA paramilitary team worked in hand with Italy's intelligence service. They notified Italy's intelligence service in advance of what they were going to do, who they were talking with. Italy's services aided them in coming in and out of the country.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Derek is telling the story about this agent. He was, I believe he's an Egyptian. He was living in Italy, whether he, I think he'd probably become an Italian citizen, or at least he was living there as a legal resident. And the Americans went to him, arrested him, put pressure on him, and got him to turn, and he became an informant, was giving the American government all sorts of information about the Islamic movement and Islamic terrorist movement in Italy. And then for some reason here a couple of years ago, they kidnapped him and sent him off to Egypt, where he's been tortured. And this was about 2 years ago. Now this information is coming out, and the Italians, of course, are demanding that the 15 Americans, obviously CIA agents or working for one or another of our intelligence agencies, who kidnapped somebody who was legally living in Italy, be returned for prosecution. So it almost looks in some ways, as Derek points out, that the Italian government or somebody within the Italian government knew what our CIA was doing over there. And it almost looks as if they're creating an international incident to begin building a barrier between Europe and the United States, sort of my take on it. In other words, all of these things are calculated. They're being done for a specific purpose. And I think that what they're going to do increasingly is isolate America. America will be on one side. Europe will be united on the other. The Americans will be the bad guys. The Europeans will be the good guys. From their point of view, the truth of the matter is, they're all bad guys. You do not use torture. You do not, certainly in many respects, create an Islamic terrorist movement that then you can justify, in the name of fighting terrorism, taking away the freedom of the American people here at home. So pick up the story there, Derek. Would you disagree or agree with my analysis?
I definitely agree with your analysis there. And overall, I think a good way to summarize it would be to mention that all of the Western countries, Britain and Italy, and as we are learning through these stories that come out, whether it's the Downing Street memos or whether it's the trial of the 13 or 15 CIA operatives who arrested the person in Italy, we are starting to see that all of these intelligence agencies are acting together, and they are acting in contrast to what the British citizens all believe should be done, and they are acting despite the common populist belief and the general principles of liberty, freedom, and sovereignty, and they're all doing it in concert towards globalist ends.
I think you're absolutely right. Now, I'm sure that many of the CIA agents involved honestly think that whatever our government does is fine. And if they violate the law, if they kill people, if they torture people, that's all right because, of course, it's going to protect America. Without understanding that there are wicked people in America who have no loyalty to this country, their loyalty is to this internationalist dream. And when you begin compromising what you know is right in the name of expediency and pragmatism, why you lay, of course, the foundation for dictatorship. And that's exactly the direction America's heading now in the name of fighting a war on terrorism, why we're losing our freedom here at home.
And so we start to realize that even if the American people got angry, just as the Italians are getting angry at the American government, the American people are not quite realizing how they are losing their perceived ability to direct the affairs of their country and their government. And I'm not sure at what point in history they ever actually had that that power to direct the direction of their country. But there is this perception that in a democracy, the American people have the way of where things go, that they should be able to control how the laws are made, that they should be able to control, how foreign policy is implemented both here and abroad. And yet, we see that apparent connection does not exist at all, that the government simply placates the American people, that the American people are being manipulated politically from both sides of the political party, and that in the background, behind the scenes, the intelligence services and powers that be are doing whatever it is that they want to do to get their agendas done.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, from sending innocent people to prison, as I believe that they did with Jim Traficant and certainly with George Hansen, both congressmen, to the murder of an American president named John Kennedy. These things are all done because there is an objective, there is a goal, and there is an invisible government that comes, as your father says so well, from the dark side.
That's right. So we need to extrapolate based on all of the news stories that we're reading as they go on. We can extrapolate that the statements that George Bush made as they were leaked out from the Downing Street memo, that we are going to go to war with Iraq and we will manipulate the evidence and to justify our position to the American people, that this is happening not just at the level of the war in Iraq, but at every single operation, whether it's Abu Ghraib, whether it's the rendition activities, whether it's the continuing funding of Middle Eastern conflicts, et cetera, these things are going to go forward irrespective of the facts, of the details, of the desires of the American people. And the bulldozer effect is real, and we've seen that here in the Downing Street memos, and we need to start extrapolating that to every single other story that is coming up recently.
Well, I think what the American people need to understand is we have no intention of bringing our troops home from the Middle East. We're building 14 major military bases in Iraq. Does that sound like we're planning on coming home and turning the country over to the Iraqis to govern themselves? We're building the largest American embassy anywhere in the world in Iraq. Do you think we'd be doing that if we were thinking of turning the government back to the Iraqis? And, of course, anybody who believes that has to be incredibly naive. We intend to have a permanent presence in the Middle East and to use that, of course, to dominate all the countries in that area and, of course, to change those governments over to those who will be willing to go along with our agenda, the New World Order, the New World Religion.
That's right. There are whole countries all over the world, Iraq itself, who are despairing of ever having ever seeing peace in Iraq. They are moving on to starting to accept a life of continuous war and occupation for the long term. The many European countries and groups are hunkering down for a long term war. Most of the Middle Eastern groups are prepared for it. The Iraqis have reached a level of cynicism that is is simply unheard of from the American perspective. All of this, in fact, it's only here in the United States where there remains a general perception and a general perception that the U.S. is trying to get something done and get out in Iraq. But reality is creeping forward and it's covering the earth, and the U.S. is the last island of irrationality regarding Iraq at this stage. That's what it seems, and the tide is rising even higher. And so you have, Rumsfeld and the U.S. president speaking almost in damage control mode against this rising tide of reality as it comes up against the fact that yes, we're going to be in Iraq for a long time,
and an awful lot more helpless and innocent Iraqi civilians and children are going to die there. And a totally contrived war. Iraq had nothing to do with the attack on 9/11. Saddam Hussein would not allow the radicals to operate in his country because he feared they would move against him. Why is it that today, as when Saddam Hussein appears in court, why all we see is simply footage, but we don't hear anything that's being said? Not that we could understand the language, but you must understand that they did not dare allow the American people to realize that we funded Saddam Hussein all during the 1980s. He was our man. He worked for us. We gave him billions and billions of dollars, and anybody doubts that, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you an article out of the Washington Post entitled When an Ally Becomes an Enemy. Saddam Hussein was our man. We created him. We financed him. We provided him with the chemical and biological weapons we're so concerned about. We backed him after he killed up to tens of thousands of Kurds, we backed him after he used poison gas to kill them. We backed him after he used poison gas to kill the Iranians in violation of every international agreement. And now, of course, Saddam Hussein is a wicked man. He's always been a wicked man. We're backing wicked men all throughout the world. How can a Christian country do that unless perhaps we've lost our vision?
And it's these kinds of lessons that you've mentioned just now that are the kinds of things that you can't have a rock concert for to try and educate around those kinds of principles. And you can't, and yet without understanding those underlying motivations, no matter how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people get together and talk about solving the problems of the world, these problems cannot be solved. And that is where I feel there is such a big discrepancy among you know, Americans and their perceptions, where they talk about and they bemoan the problems that exist in the world, and yet without understanding the machinations, the inventions of enemies, the creations and manipulations of ideas, and the fact that there are long-term agendas being built and being structured and being organized, without understanding these ideas, there's no way to effectively fight them.
And until people begin to understand that there has always been two influences in America, one the Christian and the other the occult and truly the evil. And it is the evil, of course, that has been pushing all of these various ideas of the world domination, the new world order, the new world religion, that was quite willing to finance a corrupt dictator like Saddam Hussein as long as he was expedient for us, and then for whatever reason, whether it was he wouldn't go along with our agenda, or perhaps we just wanted an excuse for a war so we could permanently station our troops in the Middle East. Why, of course, we put Saddam into an impossible situation, and now, of course, he's under arrest. But isn't it interesting that why nobody's allowed to interview him and give his view of the point of view? Now, not that I have any truck or anything good to say about Saddam Hussein. He's an evil man. But what about the people who backed him and financed him and helped him all during the 1980s? Don't they bear some responsibility? Well, some of them are working at the highest levels of our government today, and one of them, in fact, is the father of the current President of the United States. His name is George Herbert Walker Bush.
And so, you know, as you know, just like you were saying, I agree very much with all of these points. It really points to the fact that evil isn't localized in one or two people. The world of evil doesn't center around Osama bin Laden, doesn't center around Saddam Hussein. Evil is connected throughout a variety of networks all over the world. And unless people understand and start to try and make the follow-on connections of who's behind whom and who's connected to whom and who, you know, people don't rise in power in a vacuum. In fact, we say that even among ourselves and in the business world. You know, it's not just what you know and what you do, it's who you know and who you do it with that allows you to become successful in this world. Well, people who make it to the highest degrees of evil don't do it by themselves. They do it in concert with the people that they know and through friends and helpers and through other channels of power. And it's understanding that our government is one of those and is involved in that, and that there and that is a major part of that network is key to understanding what's really going on in the world and is key to understanding how to fight it ultimately.
Amen to that. All right, fine. Well, is now what's the next point you want to make?
I think it would make sense to move briefly to some of the domestic things that are going on. We've been seeing a lot happen in Supreme Court cases over the past couple of weeks. We talked last week or so about the expansion of eminent domain, allowing cities to take away individuals' private properties and give it to other private organizations such as Walmart or some mall developer, etc. We've also saw the Supreme Court filing against Grokster and the peer-to-peer organizations in a kind of a backwards deal that gives a lot to the entertainment industry. as opposed to individual programmers. We saw this week the Supreme Court continuing that trend with when it struck a major blow at the independence of journalists and their sources, ruling against the journalists in this case in the Valerie Plume outing case, who refused to reveal their sources at a, in a lower court. And the Supreme Court backed up, or the Supreme Court said that that particular case was justified in that journalists should have to give up their information and collaborate with the government agencies in this case.
But I think that's really what the significance of this is, Derek, that the Bush administration doesn't want anybody within government to tell any of the American people exactly what's going on. They're under all under gag order. And so if anybody in government who works for government should tell a reporter, leak information, now, of course, they can go after that individual. In other words, the reporter can be required to reveal his sources of information, and of course, then they can destroy that individual. They can take away his pension, they can fire him, they can hound him, and they will. I mean, they may fire you, but they will make sure you never get a job any other place, and why your family could even end up being killed, or you could end up being killed. These people will really go to any ends at all to terrorize the people who work for government so they will be silenced. And what the Supreme Court is doing is simply validating this autocratic idea that the government is separate, they're no longer answerable to the people, you know, that they are in charge and were involved in a war on terrorism, and they have the right to go to any excess at all. And this is really what's so frightening about this, is that suddenly the idea of journalistic freedom as it exists in a limited form has ceased to exist with this Supreme Court decision. We've always allowed reporters to keep their sources confidential. Quickly, before we actually lose many of our regular listeners and we have to go to the next break, please get your telephone number and your address out so when people would like to get hold of the World Affairs Brief.
All right. Go to worldaffairsbrief.com, browse around there, click on the subscribe button, and we'll send you the brief in your email that has all of the analysis about the goings-on of world affairs that we collect from news agencies all over the world. If you want a hard copy, you can call toll-free 877-518-5888. That's toll-free 877-518-5888.
And certainly want to go to worldaffairsbrief.com. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. I go there every day to see what's going on in the world so I don't have to just surf the net. Fascinating source of information, and I commend it to you very highly. And check out the weekly publication. I think you'll find it fascinating. Well, Derek, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, what we've been talking about this week are kind of two sides of things. We've been talking about the propaganda campaigns that are combined with the well-intentioned effects of youth all over the world as they try and combat what they see are the evils in the world. And those evils in the world, as they see it and their perception of it, is being manipulated into a set of generalities and ideologies which are not only unhelpful in the fact that they are non-specific and they are not able to directly combat the specific machinations of political leaders today, but in fact they are dangerous in the way that they control the way that you think about the world and how it should be fixed, and they control it in the form of leading them to believe that by banding them together and using world government types of sources, that they might be able to solve some problems. And in fact, the opposite is in fact the case, because they're not understanding that despite their good intentions and despite their standing up and yelling for what they believe, that the way things really work in the world is that individuals rise to power in concert with other organizations that have an agenda towards strengthening the power networks and the corruption networks that exist the world over.
And, of course, the ultimate goal of the people who are really in positions of power is the New World Order. the New World Religion. And so what happens so often is they will control, for instance, the people who want to advance the war in the Middle East, and they'll control the anti-war movement. And so you will see the demonstrations, the anti-war movement and demonstrations, but nobody ever asks who puts up the money, who coordinates all of this. That is the very people at the top who are controlling both the pro-war and the anti-war movement. And I'm sure you've run into that, haven't you, Derek?
That's right. And it's the idea of bringing all of these news stories together all in one place on a radio show like this, where we can talk about how the Live 8 concert works with the understanding of the news stories like Italy being complicit in the CIA snatch and grab operation, with the more common and habitual use of the rendition policies of capturing people and taking them to other countries to be tortured by U.S. paid organizations. How the Supreme Court case undermines the ability for people within the organization to try and get the right information out there through the regular press channel.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we're in real trouble as a nation. I think in large part because America has turned its back on God, and God is going to bring his vengeance on this country. I have no question at all about it. Derek, we're going to have to let you go. Do you have one parting thought for our listeners?
Well, I hope that that all of our listeners would understand that in order to understand what's going on today, we need to get our information from a variety of sources all over the world, pull them together, and start to compare them side by side. And by doing so, like looking through multiple lenses and seeing a 3D effect appear out of nothing, we start to see the real intentions and agendas that are going on in the world. And I thank you for the chance to talk about that with you today.
God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, Derek. Good night.
Right.
Bye-bye. And, of course, I certainly go to World Affairs Brief. That's www.worldaffairsbrief to get their overview of what's going on in the world. And we do go to other sources as well. But it's a pretty good evaluation of all the conservative sources. And then, of course, the sources of the Asia Times and the India Times and other news sources throughout the world that you're not going to see quoted in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Wall Street Journal, all of whom are controlled by exactly the same people, some on the left, some on the right, but none of them telling you the real truth, because that's the great tragedy we face today, is that there is an establishment, a secret government that controls both political parties, controls the right and the left. If you want to know more about this, why, of course, we have a four-tape set called The Secret Government. We have a four-tape set called Secret Societies, and of course you can even get more information if you want to get the Secret Government Special with through Radio Liberty, and it includes actually some interviews with a gentleman named William Sneblin, who was deeply involved in the occult. He was a witch, he was a Mason, he was a Satanist. He has quite a background, but the Secret Government Special gives you a tremendous amount of information on how this all fits together, because believe me, we are involved in a spiritual battle being carried out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And of course, you're not going to get an understanding of what's going on if you simply look at it Republican, conservative, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, right, left. That, of course, is to get you confused. You cannot see what the real goal is. The real goal is a one world government, the destruction of America. And, of course, a new world religion, the destruction of Judaism and Christianity. When you understand that, everything begins to fit together. So if you'd like to learn more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to know about these four tape sets, the Secret Government, the Secret Societies, or the Secret Government Special. I think my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the audio tape on Brotherhood of Darkness are all basically the same story. They tell you about secret organizations, not one, but many of them. And that's what they've done. They've created so many organizations out there, you don't know who to point out. And, of course, what you really need to do is point out literally all of them, because all of them are energized by exactly the same force. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the video, the audio tape, but they give you an overview of the spiritual forces that are working behind the scenes. We hope that many of you will go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And you may even want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to, of course, get a free copy of our newsletter. Our May newsletter talks about the occult hierarchy that rules the world. And, of course, the June newsletter, not yet available, will be the Occult Hierarchy Part 2. But if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website, radioliberty.com. You can pull down all the newsletters and begin to get an understanding of the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged in. And we'll be back in just a moment here as we talk to Candace Johnson about President Clinton's girlfriends. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have this very special guest. Her name is Candace E. Jackson. And I interviewed Candace before on her book called Their Lives, The Woman Targeted by the Clinton Machine. Now, when I, of course, made the appointment to have Candace with us, and I hope she'll forgive me for telling the story again, but, I'd forgotten who Candace Jackson was. I didn't have her book as yet, and I'm going to be interviewing her in a day or two, so I've got to find out who Candace Jackson is. And one of the tricks I use when my memory fails, why I go up in the Internet, and I pull up Candace Jackson. Well, Candace Jackson is a black stripper. And, of course, I'm thinking to myself, why am I going to be interviewing Candace Jackson? Well, fortunately, I went then down the list of all the references to Candace, and I find out there's another Candace Jackson, and that is a very proper woman who has written a fascinating book called Their Lives, and it goes into the background of William Jefferson Clinton. Candace, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome. Great to be back.
All right, fine. And what really motivated you to write this book? I think it's an important book because it tells us a lot about a man who seems to be totally rehabilitated by the media. Everybody's forgotten, really, what a scoundrel he was, and a liar, and a perjurer, and obstructed justice. And now, of course, he's out golfing with the George Herbert Walker Bush and appointed by the current president as sort of one of the co-sponsors of getting things done about after the tsunami there in Southeast Asia. And you wonder why a conservative Christian president would do everything he could to build up the prestige of such a scoundrel. Did you ever have that question?
Well, absolutely. It's quite astonishing, actually, the way that the Clintons have managed to reinvent themselves time and time again, and seem to find a lot of favor in the public eye, as if none of the different scandals and aspects of their character and behavior mattered at all. I think what primarily motivated me to write a book like this was, of all of the issues out there surrounding the Clintons, one of the ones that has always bothered me more than any other is how the Clintons, and I do mean both of them, have participated in such disrespect and mistreatment of so many women over the course of their lives and careers, and yet they wind up with these political reputations as being champions for women.
And, of course,
and it just astonishes me that's still the perception, and I'm hoping that by taking a retrospective look at the real pattern of terrible behavior against women that the Clintons have demonstrated, that maybe part of his legacy will begin to be shaped by a little bit of truth.
But you know what's even more frightening to me, Candace, is he may be back in the White House again here in 2008 with his wife, the President of the United States. She is incredibly popular. And, of course, it is said that polls suggest that if she were to run right now against George W. Bush, that she would win. And what a frightening thing it is to think of Hillary, who, of course, was as complicit as her husband in the scandals and certainly knew exactly what was going on, might be the next president of the United States.
Well, of course. They ran as a co-presidency in 1992, and if she ran in 2008, it would again be a co-presidency, whatever official title he held. They would both be back in the White House again.
All right, you hang on there, because, of course, we're going to have to take a little break here, and then we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Candace, are you on a hardline telephone or on a cell phone?
I'm so sorry. I had to be on a cell phone tonight.
Right.
I apologize.
Oh, that's all right. If there's no other alternative, why? Having you on a cell phone is better than having a lot of people on a regular hardline phone. So, anyway, of course, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself and how it was that you happened to write this book?
Sure. Well, my background is as an attorney, and I started working for Judicial Watch, a nonprofit legal organization, and that organization has actually represented several of these women I write about in various matters over the years. So it was working there that I became familiar with kind of the ins and outs of some of the what these women have had to experience at the hands of the Clintons. And based on that and a general overall concern for respect for women in this country and those kinds of issues. By the time Bill Clinton announced that it was time for him to write his autobiography and, try to shape his own legacy, I just felt strongly that he was going to leave a lot out of his memoirs and some sort of balance to that version of who he is needed to be put out there.
And, of course, you titled your book, Their Lives, as a counter to his book, My Life. Would that be a fair statement?
Exactly. He's not very modest. You can tell in the title of his autobiography. And, my instinctive reaction was, your life, Mr. President, what about the lives of so many women that you terrorized and ruined along the way?
And, of course, you simply don't go into all of them. There are a lot more that you cover about six or seven of them?
Seven, and I really that's just a representative sample of the stories that exist out there.
How many you actually had some sort of a list? What were there, 15 or 20 of them that he had that at least we know of?
Oh, the list is much longer. Absolutely, I focused on women who have been brave enough and courageous enough to talk openly about their stories.
And, of course, they all paid a tremendous price for daring to bring out the truth, because all of them, of course, were, smeared and attacked and vilified, and as part of a carefully calculated campaign, largely headed by Hillary, to discredit and destroy anybody who dared to talk against her man, as it were.
Well, exactly, and I'm sure a lot of that on her part was motivated by recognition that she had to do all she could to protect his political career, because that was what was feeding and supporting her own political career. And the pattern that emerges, whether it's towards these women or towards...
Hold that thought for just a moment, Candace, as we bring our stations back on. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Candace Jackson, Candace E. Jackson, I want to add, so you don't get it mixed up with the other Candace Jackson you'll find on the Internet. And, of course, we're talking about her book, Their Lives, The Women Targeted by the Clinton Machine. And, of course, you'll find it's a fascinating reading. And who actually published that for you?
This is World Ahead Publishing, a West Coast company.
All right, fine. Well, it's a fascinating read, and it's a fascinating book, and she's done a wonderful job of just giving the background of some of the women whose names you may have forgotten, some of the women whose names you may never heard of. But these are people who, because they had an affair, or some of them really didn't even have an affair. I mean, in the case of Paula Jones or Juanita Broderick was frankly raped by Clinton, and Paula Jones was approached, in a hotel room, and of course she was working for the state, and he's the attorney general of the state at the time. And none of these women, I think, wanted to bring anything forward, but they were more or less forced to, because their affairs with Bill Clinton were being brought out by the press, and in their own defense they really had to bring it out, and of course it cost them a terribly high price, didn't it?
Oh, it's very sad that there was such a high price to tell simply for revealing information that wasn't very favorable about a powerful person like Bill Clinton.
Right. And, of course, once you said anything about Bill, why then the big machine went to work. And there is a machine, and that machine would be set out to damage and destroy, or defame and destroy. And they knew exactly what they were doing. Did Hillary coordinate a lot of that?
Absolutely. She was instrumental in organizing and orchestrating a lot of the behind-the-scenes tactics, like hiring of private investigators to track down these women and do whatever it would take to, make sure that they wouldn't cause problems in the future. She was known to hire private investigators to keep track of Bill's movements, as well as track down any of the women who might become potential liabilities for them.
And she was really watching Bill all the time, too, wasn't she? And she even had somebody working right outside of his office to keep her advised as to who it was. She didn't care how many girlfriends he was having any trouble relations with. It was only if they were going to make any trouble for her.
From a political standpoint, right.
And I think what's the most amazing thing is that she was able to sell the American people that she was just an aggrieved, wife. Why Monica Lewinsky? Why? How could Bill have possibly betrayed her? She had no idea that this was going on. He had lied to her. Oh, think of poor me. Would you like to talk about that? That was one of the greatest acts I ever saw.
Oh, it really was. It was unbelievable. And I think she was able to capitalize on the desire of most people, I think, to prefer to see, the first lady of our country as, being taken advantage of or being some sort of victim, rather than view her as, what seems a little bit closer to the truth, that she was very concerned about her own political career and willing to do whatever it would take to protect it.
Yeah, but I think it was very, very obvious that she knew about Monica Lewinsky and everything that was going on. But, she had to let the American people believe that Bill had lied to her. And, oh, my goodness, how hurt I was when I found that my husband had been cheating on me. And it should have said, my cheating husband had cheated on me again and again and again and again and again and again. And he did it again.
It was just one more time and... Yeah, it was quite the act there for a while.
And of course, really, how tragic it is when a great country like ours could have a man bereaved of any moral fabric or fiber as the President of the United States. And if he'd cheat on his wife, and he'd cheat on all of these women, you know, what would he do with the future of America? Because people said, well, that's his private life. Is it possible to divorce a private life from a public life?
Not entirely. I don't think so. I think those issues bleed over and really do matter and should be taken into consideration. And I think there's a degree of behavior, you know, and in the case of Bill Clinton, to me, what distinguishes his behavior towards women from, say, a John Kennedy, is that it wasn't just about cheating on his wife and having affairs. He wasn't discreet about it. He consistently lied and tried to cover it up. And whenever any of the women spoke up or were forced or coerced into coming forward to talk about it, he let loose quite an intimidation campaign against them. Instead of just saying, you know what, I acknowledge it, maybe even apologize for it, leave it alone, let's move on, it's between me and my family. He didn't do that. He didn't stop there. He had to try everything possible to try to silence these women. And the level of disrespect and misogyny, I have to end up calling it, it's a very strong word, but I think it applies, that level of mistreatment of women certainly should be part of a politician's character that should matter and be taken into account. They're there not just to set an example for the country, but they're actually in their official duties. They're involved with laws and policies that have to do with issues like abuse of women in our country. And I'm not sure how we can trust those kinds of responsibilities to a person like Bill Clinton.
Well, most alley cats would blush, you know, if they were to behave like Bill Clinton did. Now, let's start off with Sally Perdue, because you have quite a section. And who was Sally Perdue, and why is she important?
Well, Sally Perdue was a woman who had a brief affair with Bill Clinton in the early 1980s, and they broke it off, and she went about her life for a while. And in the 1992 campaign, when he was running for president, she decided to appear on a talk show and talk about having had an affair with him. Well, that turned out to be a big mistake for her. How she naively thought that the American people might want to know a little bit of history about this man that they were considering voting into office. And instead, as soon as she appeared on that talk show and discussed the affair with Bill Clinton, she began being hounded. She was private investigators were sent to trail her, to dig up any dirt they could find on her. And eventually she was actually confronted by a thug who told her flat out, you can be set up with a federal job for life. And when she refused that, she was threatened. They told her, we know you go jogging by yourself, and we can't guarantee what will happen to your pretty little legs if you don't keep quiet.
And she was also told that she could be quiet while she'd be set up for life with a nice federal job, and if she, of course, didn't, why, that she could befall some terrible accident. So these people were not above using threats at all. In fact, she wasn't the only one who was threatened, was she?
Not at all. That seemed to be part of the pattern of trying to keep these women silenced and in line, was, you know, maybe first try to bribe them, and if that didn't work or stopped working, then move on to actual threats and intimidation. That kind of activity ranged from having these women followed and trailed, having their friends and family members contacted, to IRS audits, to actually, in the case of Kathleen Willey and, like we said, Sally Perdue, actually having face-to-face confrontations with thugs who told them exactly what would happen to them if they didn't shut up.
But, of course, then there was the story of Jennifer Flowers, who, of course, Bill had an affair with going off and on for, you know, a decade or more, and a good long time. And of course, one of her neighbors had foolishly set up a video camera for his security on his front door. But they had picked up Bill Clinton going into the Jennifer Flowers' home, apartment, and apparently he made the mistake of mentioning that someplace in a bar. And they almost beat him to death. They broke his arms and smashed his face. These were the thugs who were hired by, well, if they wanted the video pictures that he had of Bill Clinton. So obviously, whether it was Hillary or Bill or somebody else, they weren't above using violence, and they literally broke both of this fella's arms.
No, and crimes like that, of course, were never solved, and you know, there was never any conviction or anything like that, but you got to infer who had the most to gain by behaving that way, and that leads you right back to the Clintons.
And, of course, Larry Nichols, who, of course, was very critical of Bill Clinton, and on several occasions he was almost beaten to death. And they probably would have killed him. In one instance, if a neighbor hadn't come out, I used to interview Larry all the time. But these people were willing to use beatings and even killing people, as long as they were protecting the career of Bill Clinton. And where is the media and where are the investigative reporters to tell these stories when you need them?
No, it was a real failure on mainstream media, certainly all through the 90s, to fail to bring much of this to our attention.
All right, fine. Well, let's talk a little bit about Jennifer Flowers, because she was a very, very attractive woman, and I think that probably she was in love with Bill. You know, he was a very charming, very articulate, very glib individual. And how long did their affair go on? This was really over a period of many, many years, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, over a decade. And, you know, yes, I think she did truly fall for him. There were a lot of attractive qualities about him that really seduced her, and she's very open about that. And that's certainly one side of Bill Clinton that some women talk about and really have seen. Of course, the startling thing is there seems to be another side of Bill Clinton, and that's the side, unfortunately, that women like Paula Jones and Kathleen Willey and Juanita Broderick encounter, where it's not a charming, fun-loving side of the guy at all. It's a completely different persona.
It's like the Mr. Hyde section, right?
Right. Somebody who just takes what he wants and you know, doesn't seem to care at all.
Well, I think that's a fascinating book. It's got a lot of excellent history, background of Bill Clinton, his history, his life, and then, of course, this effort to cover up the way he treated women. But, you know, in fact, we find all the feminists are solidly behind Bill Clinton. He's a great guy. And, you know, right now, if he were to run for president against George Bush, I think he'd win. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest this evening is Candace E. Jackson. That's Candace E. Jackson, not to be confused with Candace Jackson. And we're talking about her book, Their Lives, The Women Targeted by the Clinton Machine. And there really was a machine. And anybody, of course, that they wanted to destroy, they would destroy. They would harass. They would keep them from getting jobs. They would make their lives miserable. They would threaten them and intimidate them. And when you're a woman living all by yourself, and you're talking about some of the most powerful, one of the most powerful politicians in this country and the world, who do you report to? I mean, who do you go to say, I've been wronged or I've been mistreated? And
oh,
I think
exactly.
That eventually they all ended up really living in fear for their lives, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, some of these women lived in fear for years, some of them. Kathleen Willey in particular suffered tremendously, you know, always looking over her shoulder, because there continued to be these incidents of her being followed and tracked in her hometown. It was just a very frightening experience for a lot of these women.
Well, why don't you tell a little bit about the story of Kathleen Willey, because a lot of our listeners have sort of forgotten what happened. And Kathleen didn't want to come forward. This wasn't her idea. She wasn't looking for notoriety. She didn't want this story to come out. It was embarrassing for her. But why don't you tell the story?
Sure. Kathleen Willey was a woman who was working, volunteering in the White House. She was a supporter of Bill Clinton. She and her husband had been. And in 1993, she made an appointment with Bill Clinton to ask him for a full-time job at the White House. Her husband had gotten himself into financial trouble, and she desperately needed a job. They had two kids, and she was financially very desperate. And in that meeting with Bill Clinton in the White House, in the Oval Office, instead of just talking to her, he actually molested her. He grabbed her. He wouldn't stop. He wouldn't take no for an answer. She extricated herself from the situation at last and left, humiliated, scared, told a couple of friends what had happened. But really, like she put it, who am I supposed to tell when it's the President of the United States? Who do you report that to?
Well, of course, the best thing she could, her big mistake was telling her friends, because they told other people. And, of course, unfortunately, the word got out. And then when this whole escapade started to be talked about, why, this became part of the public record. And not of her own doing, though.
No, not of her own doing at all. And, of course, that's an awful situation to force a person into. You've been mistreated, humiliated, taken advantage of, and your choice is to either take that to the grave with you and not tell a single soul, or risk the wrath of the Clintons against you. That's an awful dilemma to be put in, and that's exactly the position that each of these women ended up being put into, and it truly was an abuse of power, which is, part of why I'm out there saying, this is not just about somebody's personal life. You can't make that distinction quite so bluntly. It really is an issue of abuse of power. The Clintons had so many layers of people around them to do their dirty work that, of course, it's hard to connect the dots right back up to the top. But the inferences and the implications certainly exist that this is what they did. This is the way that they were able to use their positions of political power to try to silence any of their critics or anyone who they viewed as a possible political threat.
All right, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment as we bring our other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Candace Jackson, and we're talking about her book, Their Lives, The Women Targeted by the Clinton Machine. If you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And this is a very, very readable book. Is it available at bookstores across America today, Candace?
It is indeed, and Amazon.com, of course, and all the online book clubs, and if you go to worldahead.com, anyone can download a free chapter of the book.
Well, it's very well done, it's very well documented, it's a very readable book, and people have to understand that what has happened to the moral fabric of this society, that this man could now be golfing with the ex-president, the president's father, could be traveling all over the world, as a representative of the United States of the tsunami victims in Southeast Asia. I mean, it appears that there's nothing that you could do, no crime he could commit, that would, of course, change the way the American people think. Because, well, if these truth stories were brought out again and again, everybody would be thinking of Bill Clinton one way. But he's always being presented now by the controlled media as just this nice, likable fellow with a big smile. And of course, he's even being considered for the next president of the United Nations to replace Kofi Annan. Of course, we find that, when he left the White House with Hillary, they stole a lot of the furniture and other things that they weren't theirs. They knew that. They just took them along. But, of course, you wouldn't expect George W. Bush to do anything about it. Oh, no, let bygones be bygones. Let's appoint him. Let's try to build up his, we certainly don't want to dwell on the past. And so it's all right that he sold pardons to people, that he violated all the laws of the country. That's all right. After all, he's my good friend, Bill Clinton. Well, let's get a little bit, of course, into what happened to Jennifer Flowers. Why did Jennifer Flowers come forward and tell the truth about her affair with the president? And what happened? There were a lot of certainly rumors during the presidential campaign in 1992 associating Bill Clinton and Jennifer Flowers. Why don't you get a little bit into that story?
Sure. Well, Jennifer Flowers, after her affair with Bill Clinton ended in the late 1980s, you know, she wasn't going to go public with it. She had met somebody else and moved on with her life. She did ask him for help finding a state job when her career wasn't going well, and she received that kind of help, and she was going to keep quiet about it. She had no intention of publicly embarrassing him or calling him to task for the affair or anything like that. And then her name, you know, it's Arkansas. There was a lot of gossip going around. Her name was already linked to his. Pretty hard to carry on a completely discreet 12-year affair. And so her name began to be circulated, being linked to his. And eventually her name was published in a tabloid as having an affair with Bill Clinton. And she was hounded, you know, of course, by the media, and it became such an out-of-control situation for her that she finally decided to clear the air and say exactly what happened and admit, yes, I had an affair with Bill Clinton, and you know, she was actually in love with him and had really fallen for him, and that's, she told her story. And the price she paid for that, of course, was that her apartment was broken into. She was receiving anonymous phone calls threatening herself and her mother. She was very afraid for her safety. That's why she began taping phone conversations with Bill Clinton. And, you know, the public attacks and smearing that went on against her for the next 6 years were intense. They were vicious. And, of course, all the lies, all the denials on the Clintons' part, you know, how she's just a piece of white trash, she's a liar, she's a tramp. Of course, 6 years later, Bill Clinton himself admitted that she had been telling the truth.
But it'd been he lied during the 1992 campaign about that, didn't he?
Oh, of course he did. And it seemed to go by almost unnoticed when he finally told the truth under oath at a deposition and admitted to having the affair with Jennifer Flowers. It almost seemed to go unnoticed that he could have carried on that kind of a smear campaign against this woman for 6 years and lied over and over about it, and then had absolutely no apology and no acknowledgement when he turned around and admitted that she had been telling the truth.
Well, now, didn't she get a government job for a time?
She did. She had asked him for help finding one, and he did help her get a government job. There was actually an investigation after she was hired at that job because she was picked over many better qualified applicants, and the commission in Arkansas actually voted to compensate one of the women who didn't get the there was a Clinton crony head of the commission, and he vetoed that idea and just kind of swept the whole thing under the rug. So that's the kind of abuse of power that we're talking about, the length that the Clintons would always go to keep any of these women happy enough to keep them quiet.
Hold on, we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Candace Jackson. We're talking about her book, Their Lives, and it's a fascinating, you know, just a summary and a story of Bill Clinton, and really what a scoundrel he was, but of course the force behind Bill Clinton was always Hillary. And she, of course, was leading the effort to demonize and destroy, slash and burn, all anything, of course, to destroy the reputation of anybody who could, of course, expose really what a terrible, terrible and evil, fundamentally evil person Bill Clinton was. Charming, but of course, basically evil, vindictive, and of course, there are many, many stories of people dying under very mysterious circumstances. There was, not although mentioned in this book, but there was a private detective who had been getting information on Bill Clinton when he was the governor of Arkansas, and this private detective, a great big bulwark of a man, bull of a man, 260 pounds, was gunned down in his car in a typical gangland slaying, and of course the police covered it up. There was always someone there to cover up what Bill had done. And certainly Jennifer Flowers, that of course came under tremendous persecution, and she had met a man, she was in love with him, and when this whole thing came out, why, he just picked up and left her. But the story does have a happy ending, doesn't it?
It does indeed. That she ended up marrying him, and they're happily married, living in New Orleans today. So she did manage to pick up the pieces and like a lot of these women, and move on with their lives and recover somewhat. I think part of what I'm after with this book is hoping that if the Clintons themselves remain unwilling to do any justice by these women, refuse to apologize for what they've done, refuse to take any responsibility for what they've done, then maybe discussing it amongst ourselves, maybe we can help hold the Clintons accountable someday for all these things that they've done.
And now Jennifer is, of course, apparently she was a very beautiful woman. She's married. Her husband has a nightclub for her. Basically, the Clintons were able to keep her from getting a job literally any place in the United States. And if she got a job, they'd see to it that she lost the job. Well, fortunately, her husband bought the nightclub for her, and they have one in New Orleans. Is it on Bourbon Street or off Bourbon Street?
It's right in the quarter there.
All right,
it's
fine.
On Bourbon Street.
So you can actually go to New Orleans and see Jennifer Flowers. And I don't think she's proud of what happened, but she is simply an example of the victimization of a woman who foolishly fell in love with a married man, but she didn't understand that this was probably the most dangerous thing that she could possibly do, because of what happened to so many of Bill Clinton's women, and of course the terrible pressure they were put under. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just, of course, talking with Candace Jackson about the story of Jennifer Flowers. Basically, she was persecuted. She lost a job. She tried to get jobs at any place. She got a job. People working behind the scenes for the Clintons or whoever they were working for would make sure she lost the job, and it wasn't until she got married. And, of course, her husband bought a nightclub there on the corner of Bourbon Street in New Orleans that she was able to sing, and apparently she now has a successful life, but she's put Bill Clinton behind her. Is that right?
To a large extent, yes. I mean, you almost have to, and that's part of what I think is actually inspiring about a lot of these women's stories, is that they never got to receive any sort of justice from this situation. The Clintons were never convicted of anything. They've escaped with this reputation of, you know, still being popular in this country. And yet these women have managed to overcome a lot of that, and, you know, while they don't have any warm feelings towards the Clintons, they have managed to, you know, practice, you know, some forgiveness and some healing and really move on with their lives. And that should be inspiring for all of us.
Well, now, tell us a little bit about Paula Jones. I mean, this was an amazing story, and this is one of the things that, of course, led eventually to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. It's just such a shame that, that Trent Lott, the 33rd degree Mason, who, of course, was the majority leader in the House, would not do anything about his fellow or individual. Of course, Bill Clinton was one of the highest ranking demolays in the country, and Trent Lott, you know, true to his oaths, could never do anything against a member or associate of the secret society. But anyway, what happened to Paula Jones, and how did this whole thing fit together? And what happened to Paula, you know, after she came forward and told the truth about being accosted in a hotel room by the man who would become the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States?
Well, Paula Jones's life was entirely upended by this entire experience, and it all began when she decided, after having been harassed and molested by Bill Clinton, she was going to keep quiet about it. There was no one she felt safe that she could report this to.
Now, he was the Attorney General of the state of Arkansas at the time he accosted her.
He was the governor. It was in 1991.
Well,
he was just a few months away from announcing his bid for president.
Okay, fine. So then what? Just tell the story.
Yeah, and in fact, she remained quiet for a couple of years, and it wasn't until one of the troopers who had escorted her up to Bill Clinton's hotel room came forward in a magazine article in the American Spectator, you might remember it, and talked about this woman, Paula, who he had escorted up there that day at that hotel in Arkansas, and the magazine article had the trooper saying that this woman, Paula, had come out of the hotel room talking about having had a a gratifying experience with Bill Clinton and that she wanted to be his girlfriend. And Paula Jones saw that article and she was horrified. She was mortified. That was the furthest thing from the truth of what had happened.
Was that Larry Patterson who wrote the article, do you recall? He was one of the two.
David Brock, I believe, wrote the article.
Okay, fine. Okay, David Brock was a homosexual who was actually working for the American Spectator at the time, as I remember. Go ahead.
At the time he was, right. Okay. It was in 1993. And so he printed this stories by these Arkansas State Troopers who had been working with Bill Clinton. Paula Jones reads the story, and she's just horrified and thinks, it all started, she just wanted to clear her name. She just wanted an apology from the White House, a clarification that, yes, they met in that hotel room, but she did nothing wrong. That's all she wanted from Bill Clinton. And, of course, instead of standing up like a man and accepting that kind of responsibility and helping to clear this woman's name, he instead dragged her into a 5.5-year court battle. She filed the lawsuit against him for sexual harassment and false imprisonment and all kinds of charges, and it was a 5.5-year ordeal, millions of dollars in legal fees. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court and back. Her lawsuit was eventually dismissed by a federal judge, but she appealed it, and it seemed like the appellate court was leaning in her favor. And at that point, finally, Bill Clinton actually settled with her for $800,000, $850,000, I believe.
Wasn't it one of his friends who put up the money? He didn't put up the money, or did he?
I don't know whether he personally paid it or not. But it was not just financial victory; it was a moral victory for Paula Jones, because that was a clear indication that he was in trouble.
And it was, did Judicial Watch handle that case, or were they involved in it anyway?
No, not in that case.
All right, fine. So anyway, of course, then they pay off Paula Jones, which is a tacit admission that her story is true, and they don't want to take it to court. I assume that probably the lawyers got most of the settlement, didn't they?
Oh, yes. Paula Jones didn't really see a nickel out of that settlement by the time the lawyers got done dividing up all the fees. Because remember, this had stretched on for 5.5 years. There were many lawyers involved. And she ended up, she lost her marriage over this. The publicity and the trauma of going through all of this broke up her marriage. So she was a single mother after all this. And, financially unstable. That's when she made the decision to pose nude for a men's magazine.
That was a terrible mistake on her part, because that tended to discredit, her in the lives of many people, in the minds of many people.
Yeah, it's tough to imagine, I think, what she was going through. She talked about how, a lot of people who had been supportive of her during the lawsuit, once it was all over with, nobody was there for her. She was alone. She was a single mother struggling financially and, made the decision to take the money and do that. But this is what I'm talking about, the kind of depth that the Clintons' behavior has pushed these women to. It's put them in very desperate situations.
And let's talk a little bit about Juanita Broderick, because Juanita Broderick was certainly an innocent individual, and of course her story, they had it, I think it was NBC or ABC, had the whole story, and they intentionally and purposely and willfully, and I believe maliciously, withheld that information until after the impeachment trial that had gone to the Senate of the United States. They knew exactly what had happened, but they didn't want the American people to know until, of course, Clinton had been exonerated by the United States Senate. Who is Juanita Broderick? Why is this story important?
Oh, Juanita Broderick's story is the real tragedy in all of this. It was such a vicious assault. She was a business owner in Arkansas while Bill Clinton was the state attorney general running for governor in Arkansas, and she volunteered to help his campaign. She liked him, thought he had some good ideas for running the state, so she wanted to help his gubernatorial campaign. And when she was at a conference in Arkansas, she called his campaign and asked if she could talk to him about helping out, and he agreed to meet with her at the hotel that she was staying at. She asked to meet in the coffee shop downstairs, and he called her back and said, oh, there are too many reporters there. Can we meet in your hotel room? She didn't think anything of it. This was the attorney general of the state. She had felt no reason to be afraid of him or you know, think it was too strange to meet with him to talk about the campaign in her hotel room. But once they got there, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't more than 5 minutes before, after a little bit of small talk, he just pushed himself on her. He wouldn't take no for an answer. She was crying. She was screaming. He bit her lip to keep her quiet as he sexually assaulted her. It was rape, and it was very cold-hearted, very vicious. He left the room saying, oh, you better put some ice on that, because her lip was bruised and swollen and bleeding. That was the Bill Clinton that Juanita Broderick encountered, and of course, she told some family members and friends what had happened, but she was too scared to report it to the police, so she didn't. And she talks about how in 1992, many years after the rape, Bill Clinton ran into her at a conference and approached her and tried to apologize. She says, oh, I'm so sorry for what I've done. I'm a changed man. Can you ever forgive me? And, you know, she told him to you know, go you know where and walked away. And, of course, a few weeks after that incident, he announced his candidacy for president. So she knew right then that all he was trying to do was ensure that she would keep quiet about it. And she did. She kept quiet about it all through the 1990s until her name had been rumored enough that she finally had the courage, after talking actually with Kathleen Willey about Kathleen Willey's experience in coming forward, Juanita Broderick finally became convinced that as much pain as it caused her to relive what happened, that the American people needed to know what this man had been capable of, what he had done to her. And yep. That's, as you said, that's when she was investigated for months by NBC, and they interviewed her at length and investigated her story for months, trying to find holes in it, trying to decrease her credibility. They couldn't do it. It was very credible. And instead, they sat on the story, withheld it, and refused to air it until after the impeachment hearing.
And they had it. They promised her. The only reason she gave in the interview was the promise that they would air it. And, of course, they intentionally withheld it because they didn't want the American people to know until the threat of impeachment was over. In other words, here is an example of total complicity of the NBC in covering up a crime. And this is what's so unconscionable about what's going on today. And there's no outcry at all, you know, about this man now who's been rehabilitated. He's a friend of the president's father and, of course, traveling throughout the world representing the United States. What impression do you think that people in the other countries have towards America, you know, and knowing about, of course, all the stories we've told and then about Monica Lewinsky and the other vile and repulsive things that this man has done? I mean, how can other countries have any respect from America? We've lost the moral high ground, especially when Bill Clinton now may once again be in the White House with the next president, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Oh, I hope not. I hope not.
Well, let's hope that your book will at least have an opportunity to reach people. Incidentally, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you'd like to give us a call, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I don't necessarily like that, having programs that are salacious and quite as graphic as this one, but I think you have to understand that the next president of the United States may very well be the person who covered up all of this, because Hillary was really the person who coordinated all the slash and burn techniques that were done to destroy anyone who tried to get the truth out about the sexual predator she was married to.
Well, absolutely, and you know, the fact is she was in a unique position to call attention and criticize this kind of awful behavior, and instead, by remaining silent about it and even participating in tearing down anyone who did try to call attention to it, you know, I believe she set an example more than anybody else that this kind of behavior is acceptable in our society, and that's a tragedy.
And, of course, I think the story of Monica Lewinsky, and there's probably much more to this story than we've really recognized or maybe we'll ever know, but I know that Monica Lewinsky eventually came to realize that how dangerous this man was. I'm talking about Bill Clinton. In fact, I've heard it said that she had actually taken a list of some 50 or more people who had been murdered, during Clinton's rise to power, and put that list on bench or the seat where Linda Tripp, who had actually brought this whole story forward and exposed to the press what Monica had told her about her relationship with Bill Clinton, and said, "Linda, do you really want to go forward and testify and point a finger at Bill Clinton? This is a list of other people who pointed a finger at him." Has you ever heard that story?
No, actually, I hadn't heard that.
I have that in a couple of other books. So, of course, you can't cover everything in your book. But there's no question at all that I think after a time, even Monica Lewinsky began to realize that she was playing in a league way outside of her abilities.
Well, I think almost any one of us would find ourselves outmanned and outgunned facing the Clinton team. It's been outrageous and amazing, the level of power that they've been able to execute over people.
And, of course, there was one woman who worked for Bill Clinton, who'd been with him for a long time, and she did everything to cover up all of his indiscretions and, of course, to destroy anybody who, of course, was getting too close to the truth. Who was that? That wasn't... she was working, of course, I suppose, with Hillary or for Hillary, but she was one of the managers for Bill Clinton, wasn't she?
Well, there was Betsy Wright.
Betsy Wright, that's where
we're
thinking of.
Yes, a very, very key player. She actually came up with the phrase "bimbo eruptions," and it was her duty for years and years to do whatever it took to keep Bill Clinton out of hot water when it came to his women troubles.
And, of course, we're talking really about dozens of women. We've only mentioned seven in this book, but there were so many there that, of course, would not necessarily come forward for fear of embarrassment or for fear of retaliation. For fear of their lives. I think that Monica Lewinsky was fear for her life, as were certainly the other women when they began to understand the true nature of the man that they were dealing with. Or at least the force that was behind the man that they were dealing with.
Absolutely. And, one thing that struck me researching and writing this book was the connection I find between Bill Clinton's liberal politics and his abuse of power and abuse of women like this. And I think there's actually a connection that drives or helps to further this kind of mistreatment. I think it's important to remember that when we're talking about the Clintons and their abuses of power, it's not a situation that's necessarily unique to the Clintons. I think that there is an actual danger in liberal ideology that needs to be talked about.
And, of course, it seems that there are really no curbs on this sort of thing. We know, of course, that Jim McDougal, who was ready to testify against the President of the United States, and why he was left in prison, and he died under very serious, mysterious circumstances. Of course, many people think that he was killed, but his wife was too smart. She was rather go to prison on a contempt citation rather than testify against Bill Clinton. And, of course, it was simply not by accident that Jim McDougal's wife was pardoned by the president during the closing days of his administration. Isn't that... that was really a very, very strange situation. How did he get away with that?
Oh, it's just amazing how many people surround the Clintons who are either willing to do the dirty work for them or are willing to take the fall for them. And that's actually part of what I think the connection is. This liberal mindset, they actually believe that the Clintons deserve to have power and that we should and that people should do whatever it takes to keep the Clintons in power, because their liberal beliefs, their liberal politics are doing so much good for the world and for the country. I think a lot of the people around them, maybe like the McDougals, genuinely believe that.
We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is Candace Jackson, and, of course, we're talking about her book, their lives, referring to, of course, the lives of Bill Clinton's women. And it's a counterpart to his book, My Life, which is, of course, Bill Clinton's lying autobiography, in which he left out so much of the information. If he was going to be honest, you'd think he would have been. But then why would anybody expect that Bill Clinton would be honest? After writing a book about Bill Clinton and his women, what is your impression of him as a human being?
Oh, I think if there's one word that sums him up, it might be narcissistic. I think he has a very tragic mixture of a huge ego and yet a lack of genuine self-esteem. I think he engages in self-destructive behavior and vicious behavior towards other people, almost out of a desperate need for attention. He has a need to be loved and adored, and that's why he's willing to do whatever it takes to quiet anybody and silence anybody who threatens to tarnish his reputation.
Well, do you think he was behind this? Do you think Hillary was behind this? Do you think that he was always looking for somebody else to clean up the mess that he'd made?
Well, I think when it came to doing a lot of the actual dirty work, you know, hiring the private investigators and, you know, having these women threatened with bodily injury, he was, I think his personality was more the type to let other people take care of that. Now, of course, there's this other side of his personality that had no problem doing the actual dirty work himself when it came to molesting and raping women. So there's also that side of his personality. But, you know, he and Hillary made a wonderful team in the sense that she was able to look at a situation and approach it in, you know, kind of almost a military kind of a way and just, you know, here's what needs to be done. We're going to war on this. We're going to fight back. And you know, I'm not sure that was quite his personality or his style.
Yeah, but certainly that was Hillary's, and she was going to slash and burn anybody who got in the way. I think that sure, she was the real strong person. This is my impression. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I think she's a very strong person. Absolutely. I think that she had the ability to not look at the human side of anything that was going on and keep, you know, one goal in mind and do whatever it took to reach that goal. And, of course, that was to make sure that Bill Clinton stayed in power because that was her best shot of getting in power.
And power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts Hillary Clinton. Well, thank you so very much for being with us, Candace. It's always a pleasure. We'll have you on one of our other audience programs with another audience here very soon. But thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Of course, our guest this evening was Candace Jackson, and of course, we were just discussing, you know, off the air, what about Bill Clinton? Well, he was a man, of course, very narcissistic. He could be very violent towards women. I think he was, in some respects, almost a sociopath. But he was married to a woman, of course, who was vicious. And she really headed this whole movement to destroy anybody who got in their way. And they were not above, of course, having people murdered. They were not. I mean, certainly Vince Foster was very obviously murdered, and the Clinton administration covered up for it. The same thing with Ron Brown. The same thing with the special investigator who was following Bill Clinton and keeping files on him. And of course, if you read the story of Monica Lewinsky, of course, had taken a list of 50 people who were associated with the Clintons' rise to power, who had all been killed, and she'd actually put that list on Linda Tripp's chair there where Linda was working, and said, Linda, do you really want to testify against this man? And this is really what we're worrying, what we're looking at. And yet, of course, Hillary today is the leading candidate for the Democrat nomination, and it may well be that she will become the next president of the United States. Bill Clinton has been rehabilitated and, of course, now is traveling around with the George Herbert Walker Bush, the previous president, our American representative for tsunami relief, has been built up by the media and, of course, by the Bush administration, which refused to take any action against him for selling pardons there at the end of his term in office, for stealing things from the White House, for violating all sorts of laws, but nobody even talks about What Happened to Clinton's Women. Well, this is an excellent book, and we recommend it to you. It's called Their Lives, The Women Targeted by the Clinton Machine. So, but you have to understand this. You must understand that there really are evil forces in the world. You can't understand this book or any other book written about the Clintons unless you understand that there really are people who are dealing with another dimension. After all, it was Hillary who invited Jean Houston to the White House to conjure up spirits, the spirit of Eleanor Roosevelt, the spirit of Mohandas Gandhi. What are you talking about, conjuring up spirits? Ladies and gentlemen, we're involved in a spiritual battle. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to read it. You need to understand what we're really dealing with. There is another dimension. There's a demonic dimension. We're involved in a spiritual battle. And most people have no idea what's really going on. And I'm not just picking on the Clintons. After all, both Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan were deeply involved with astrology. And Nancy was going to an astrologer on a regular basis to get advice for her husband, the president. I knew the astrologer's closest friend, Dr. Field, who I had a chance to meet at the CMA. And Nancy was, of course, contacting the astrologer for advice from the other dimension. To directing the affairs under the Republican president. So we have bilateral party affiliation with spiritualism and with the other dimension. Understand what's really going on. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will give you an overview, and we have so many other books. I suggest perhaps our latest newsletter, the one that's available on the Internet, the May 2005 Radio Liberty letter entitled The Occult Hierarchy, Part 1. The Occult Hierarchy Part 2 will be coming out very, very shortly, and will take you further into the spiritual forces that rule the world. And there really are spiritual forces. And, of course, we quote from people who are affiliated with those spiritual forces, and we tell you who those people are who are involved. Fascinating letter. That's the Occult Hierarchy 1, and Occult Hierarchy 2 will be available if you'd like. Occult Hierarchy 1, you don't have access to the Internet, where you, of course, get the letter at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. We'll be glad to send you a copy of the Occult Hierarchy Part 1, and when 2 is available, we'll send that to you. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle for the survival of souls and the preservation of Western civilization. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.